Hi, it's Greg Dalton. I'd like to hear your comments on the show, topics we should cover, and guest suggestions. You can reach me at greg@climateone.org. This is Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton. Climate is often called a threat multiplier because it can worsen already challenging situations.
Climate insecurity is linked much to water insecurity, which in our part of the world is also connected to the conflict.
And places experiencing ongoing armed conflict, such as Ukraine, how do those working to address the climate crisis keep moving forward?
Practical action is something you can use to calm the fear, to calm the uncertainty.
A Palestinian environmentalist says even in the midst of daily struggles, the climate emergency requires action.
We are committed because if people like us give up, who else would do the job? Who else would keep the light of hope going?
Climate action in conflict zones, up next on Climate One. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has caused horrific damage and casualties, in spite of Ukraine's heroic efforts to defend itself. The conflict has disrupted global energy markets, grain shipments, and is still impacting the global economy. All of this shoved climate further down the list of international priorities, as has happened so many times before. Yet within conflict zones, many brave individuals and organizations work every day to stave off the even greater threat of climate catastrophe. Today, we talk with two guests about the realities of operating environmental organizations in conflict zones and how to balance immediate needs with working toward a better future. Roman Zinchenko is co-founder of Greencubator, an organization focused on sustainable entrepreneurship, the green economy, and low-carbon innovations in Ukraine and Eastern Europe. For the last few months, Roman has been commuting between Ukraine's capital of Kyiv and his family's home city. I asked him to tell us a bit about his daily life in the middle of the ongoing war.
So I'm lucky that all the lives in our family, everybody's fine. We have no properties destroyed. We do have the friends serving in the army now. We do have the friends and partners who were either wounded or killed during the fights. And we are getting the information firsthand. And that's eye-opening. So first it's shocking. Then, like, from my perspective, from my experience, it's a kind of tremor and maybe panic, and then you're starting to act. Because in my case, the practical action is something you can use to calm the fear, to calm the uncertainty. Mm-hmm. So we saw millions of people leaving the country. We helped many of them. Well, one of our projects was building a shelter for the mothers with kids in Lviv that were going overseas. Also, we have a different front, which is the front of economy, the front of business, the front of education, where we are serving. But the interesting point here is how people are focusing some of their efforts on the activities they are doing to support the country, to support the Ukraine's defenders on the front lines, to how they volunteer, etc. On another hand, I had the chance to see some return of the, let's say, normal life to some of the cities that heard rocket shelling and artillery shelling, and now they look really peaceful. But when you are entering the city by car, you see a range of the warehouses and homes burnt down and armored vehicles still on the sides of the road that were destroyed after the Russian invasion started. So the country has its shocks, and the war is a terrible thing, and we lost a lot of brilliant people. We lost a lot of our heritage. We lost a lot of our economy. On the other hand, it shows how adaptable we are and how we are able to reinvent the way of living under tough situation.
I'm just curious what it's like operating an environmental organization in a conflict zone where you're hearing from friends who are on the front lines and trying to balance those two things.
Well, you're just getting several new layers of the picture of the world, and you are adding some new layers of activities and slashing the redundant the redundancies. So in our case, we donated all our PV modules we had in our offices to the need for the military. We started the foundation to provide assistance for the defenders of Ukraine. We made sure all our friends we know who are serving in the army now, they're getting the protection, the communication equipment and support they need, because, well, Ukraine had to grow the army more than triple-fold starting the Russian invasion. And at some point, you understand that you still have your job to and your front to fight, and this is the front of serving green economy. So we almost restored all our programs that were operational before the full-scale Russian invasion. And of course, we had a lot of, you know, dual lives. We are living dual lives. So I'm the project manager in the foundation, and I'm the project leader in Green Incubator, and also I'm a father and a friend and a son. So a lot of these roles have a lot of nuances added, etc.
It's an interesting juxtaposition of time frames, you know, sending solar equipment to the frontline troops and, you know, the needs, immediate fighting needs of today, and building companies and technologies and giving funds to entrepreneurs who are trying to build something on a longer time frame in the peaceful areas. How do you compare adapting to war to adapting to climate change, those things that operate on different timescales and have a different human face?
I think there is a real danger in terms of climate change that it's not so visible. So still some people manage to deny the war. Still some people in Russia, and not just in Russia, saying, oh, no, there is no war. That's just special operation. The climate change is crawling. But so you can't hear in the morning that the rockets are hitting your city. Yeah, so with the climate change, sure, there are some wildfires in the forests, there are some deforestation, losses of natural diversity, losses of land fertility, and many other challenges. But the danger of the climate change, it comes slowly and it creeps in. Until someday you just see that your land is no longer fertile without irrigation, and you just cannot ensure irrigation on this land because the water levels in the rivers were lost. So the war is loud. The climate change, not always. But on the other hand, well, we had 8 years of the war, invisible war before that, after Russia annexed the Crimea. So the impact of climate change may be harder to see and harder to hit the front lines of the media. But that's why we should work on that too, because from the environmental damage perspective, not just Ukraine, but the world was hit immensely hard, and the environmental losses of this Russian invasion are huge. The fires, the spillover of toxic chemicals, the burnt oil depots, the explosives that are now laying in our fields and our forests. So there's a lot of environmental damage.
Right. And people don't often think about war and cancer, though the U.S. Congress recently passed some funding for veterans of American troops who have high incidences of cancer, in part because of the burn pits that the military uses to burn, you know, many of their equipment, et cetera. And people get cancer long after they've been serving in the military. Let's connect, you know, the war with energy. How is the war connected with climate? And how does Russia view renewable energy?
Well, there is a very interesting document of the Russian national security strategy. If I'm not mistaken, it was adopted in the spring 2015, which directly quotes the proliferation of renewable energy, new energy sources, and energy efficiency as a direct threat to the Russian national security. And the current war Russia started against Ukraine is clearly fossil funded. So even with the current sanctions, even with the Russia choking the large parts of Europe with the shrinking gas supplies, because, for example, on the Finnish border, they just started to burn the huge amount of natural gas they were pumping to Finland and some other European customers. And you imagine the level of CO2 from that huge fires. The current invasion is fossil funded, and it's funded through building the energy dictatorship. So Russia had been working tirelessly for over the decades to build that energy grip, and they continue doing that. They continue doing that not just through the gas, but they also keep continuing it through the nuclear. And they are now very active promoting their nuclear technologies and nuclear power stations for many countries, including the countries of Africa, which would tie them for decades to the Russian technology, the source of nuclear fuel and other things. The strange story, actually, is Ukrainian oil and gas fields were the starting point right after the World War II, that they were first fueling the large parts of the Soviet Union, and now we are a large transit player in terms of supplying Russian gas from Siberian oil and gas fields to Europe. And Russia undermined all of the diversification efforts. Russia undermined all of the energy efficiency efforts, and it was paid handsomely for all the rockets hitting Ukrainian cities now for the oil and gas. So that's clearly the war of the energy dictatorship, because we can clearly say that Russia is the energy dictatorship on one hand, and that's clearly the war of the old energy technology against new energy technology and against the market approaches, etc. We are paying the big price, the tragic price, for the world to see that, to witness that, to understand that. We are paying the price of the thousands and thousands of lives lost, and cities and villages razed from the earth. But still, we are holding. We are a resilient country. We have resilient communities. And I think that this period would be also a huge push towards the new opportunities for Ukraine as the player in the energy field, as the player in sustainability field, and as a player also in the business field.
Coming up, what energy lessons should the world take from witnessing Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Well, the first energy lesson in this case is stifling the innovation for the sake of your future enemy is a bad strategy. And we should be honest, the world was stifling a lot of innovations in the energy field, motivated by cheap Russian gas.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
Today, we're focused on the challenges of working toward climate action in conflict zones. Let's return to my conversation with Roman Zinchenko, co-founder of Greencubator, an organization focused on sustainable entrepreneurship and innovation in Ukraine and Eastern Europe. Prior to Russia's invasion in February, Ukraine was connected to the Russian electric grid. Roman says the invasion and resulting disconnection of the two countries' grids forced Ukraine to accelerate its plan to join the European energy market.
And now we are synchronized with the European energy grid. We are one of the exporters there because we have energy profit at the moment. Due to the Russian invasion, we have lost a lot of industrial capacities in the east and in the south. So many of them were destroyed. Some of them were shut down. The economic activity is now rebounding. But still, you know, if you are losing the steel plant, that's a huge consumer of the energy. So we have energy profit now, and Ukraine is exporting some of the energy to European Union, also to Moldova. And I do hope that we will be benefiting in terms of grid innovations, including the energy storage system. Our parliament has recently passed a new law allowing the energy storage systems to be integrating in the grid, including, for example, biogas integration into natural gas distribution grids and some other activities. And also Ukraine is very actively discussing green hydrogen partnerships with the European Union countries. The challenge is that some of these projects were planned in the southern parts of Ukraine, and some of these parts are now occupied by the Russian troops. But luckily, the part of in the Odessa region where the sun is immensely generous and rich, they have the potential. So this is the free land, and they have the potential for this project's development. So this is a lot of work, and I should say that the people in Ukraine's energy sector, they are super resilient, and I'm extremely proud of their sometimes life-risking effort to keep the country with the power, to keep the lights on, and to restore what was destroyed during the fighting.
So it sounds like since World War II, Russia cultivated Ukraine's dependence on Russian sources of energy, squashed innovation, squashed efficiency, and Ukraine adapted pretty quickly in connecting its electric grid to Europe, cutting it off from Russia. Now Ukraine has a surplus of electricity because factories are not operating, and you're moving, at least in an energy sense, closer to Europe, which is supposedly what this war was supposedly to prevent in the first place. Is distributed energy more resilient? We saw Russian forces attacking a Ukrainian nuclear plant. Are you now much more resilient and adaptive because you're more decentralized?
Well, the decentralized energy system is yet to be built in Ukraine, but I'm really proud that my co-founder and brother Andriy has invested a lot of his efforts and significant part of his life into making decentralized energy system happen. So one of the Green Incubator spin-offs, the project which is called Solar Town, is the municipal solar energy cooperative in the city of Slavutich. Slavutich is Ukraine's youngest city. It was built to replace Pripyat after Chernobyl nuclear disaster. And this is the city built for nuclear engineers that were running Chernobyl nuclear power plant after the explosion in 1986. Slavutich was occupied for some time, and there was also a loss of power, the loss of electricity grid. So the energy co-op, which is 250 kilowatts solar power station, was an important backup power for the community of the cities, and they were able to use some of the energy for it to power the communications, to get some life-needed energy. Luckily, the city is practically intact, and there was no big fighting there, so it's now free part of Ukraine. But we saw it. On the other hand, there is now increasing movement of the Ukrainian solar station home solar owners to convert them from the grid, connect them from the network stations, working in sync with grid with the hybrid stations, and they are preparing maybe for hard winter, because that winter would be really tough for Ukrainian energy system, including the heat supply. And we are relying to a large extent to decentralized heat supply in our cities. And people are installing a lot of energy storage, and they're making sure that their solar production would be working independently if grid is on or if grid is off.
Is that storage on the individual home level? And how are people, how is that funded?
Well, it's self-funded. The feed-in tariff in Ukraine was pretty attractive model for this for the renewable generation stimulation. It was tied to the hard currency. It was pretty high. So a lot of people were installing solar systems at their homes as alternative investment models. And the payback periods for the home solar was around 6 to 7 years, which is nice.
That's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, so the prices were high. The problem is currently the government policy is not providing that support any longer. But there's another model. We are witnessing the energy prices hikes. And a lot of large businesses are considering to have their own solar arrays, solar station, to compensate part of their consumption. And these are pretty large installations on the logistics centers, supermarkets, etc. So, but the war is not the best time for making these investments. But before the full-scale invasion, that was a really important trend. And we have also another trend. There is a lot of ideas voiced regarding the green recovery and the green recovery plan of Ukraine for rebuilding the cities and homes that were destroyed.
Yeah, and we've seen that in other places that have been hit by, you know, hurricanes. You know, Haiti had a recovery of their electric system that was more distributed in solar, and it's interesting to watch that. You know, pulling back, what lessons should the world take from witnessing Russia's invasion of Ukraine as it relates to energy? What's the energy lesson of this story?
Well, the first energy lesson in this case is stifling the innovation for the sake of your future enemy is a bad strategy. And we should be honest, the world was stifling a lot of innovations in the energy field, motivated by cheap Russian gas. So now it's no longer cheap. And it costs a lot for everybody. This is the first thing. The second very practical thing, civic passum parabellum. So you should be prepared for the fight. And what is saving Ukraine now, we had this fight for 8 years since the Russian annexation of Crimea. We had hidden but active war, and a lot of Ukrainian defenders learned how to work in that. And thirdly, yes, invest in the resilient energy systems that are stress tested, that can provide at least the basic needs in case of major heats, in case of major attacks, in case of cyber attacks, or just physical destruction by kinetic or other weapons. So resiliency is really important, and resiliency of energy systems is uber important because, well, we do not sometimes understand that this basic convenience is very fragile.
Right, and I saw that this month the U.S. Department of Energy sent $30 million in emergency funds to advance both the integration of the Ukrainian grid with Europe and also to address those cyber and physical security things you're talking about. You know, how is the idea of energy independence tied to your idea of personal freedom and freedom from Russia's energy dictatorship?
That was actually the core idea in Green Incubator's creation 13 years ago. So my dad, who is history professor, my brother Andriy, and me were just saving money during the crisis of 2008, where we lost our businesses, jobs, and what we were doing installation of the heating systems and electricity by ourselves. My dad's first diploma is electrical engineering, second is math, and third is history. So he had some training, and we were doing it with also with some basic experience. And we faced the really significant challenge. That was the challenge of connecting the single family home, the country home, to the grid. And it took extra effort to avoid any bribes on getting that place connected. So from that, we understood, there is some pain point for the country. And later we learned that there is also a huge pain point for the businesses that are facing significant challenges getting access to the electricity to run the business and to pay for this electricity. And that wasn't the most transparent practices and corruption-free practices in this market. So that was actually one of the sources where idea for Greencubator arrived. Another source was actually Crimea. We were doing the small consulting project in the city of Sevastopol, and we were surprised how such a sun-rich land is not using the renewables they should have been using, and they were just heating the water in the hotels with electricity while they could easily put the solar heaters on their roofs. So that was another source of inspiration. So at some point we just came with the idea of Greencubator being the source of prosperity, new business idea, partnerships for the green businesses of Ukraine. And now we are serving the trope. My brother is helping to launch energy cooperatives. I'm focusing more on the broader spectrum of sustainability-minded entrepreneurs. But at some point, was probably 2015, we also hold the conference named Energy Democracy Against Energy Dictatorship. Ukrainians, as both many individuals and many institutions, have been warning that the energy dictatorship would hit someday. And the Nord Stream 2 was one of that big warning, but the world preferred to keep that gas pipeline being built until the invasion hit.
Well, Roman, thank you so much for sharing your story and your time. And I don't have a loss of words for what you're going through and balancing during the Russian invasion to try to build a cleaner, more independent future for your country and your family. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me here. And also thank you very much for you and all your team for raising the new generation of climate innovators, climate entrepreneurs, and climate-minded thinkers.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has dominated headlines for most of the year, but many parts of the world have seen sustained armed conflict for decades. Nada Majdalani is a Palestinian whose whole life has been shaped by perennial conflict in the Middle East.
I was born in Bulgaria. We moved then to Tunisia and Libya, and my parents before that were also all over the place between Syria and Lebanon. So the notion that we didn't have somewhere to settle was something not actually very nice for a child, because moving around means that you cannot sustain friends and you cannot, you know, keep relationships.
In 1993, a pair of agreements known as the Oslo Accords were signed between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization, a major milestone in the peace process. Following those accords, Nada and her family returned to Palestine. She was 11 years old.
It was like a dream. I remember crossing back from Jordan to Palestine with a truck full of boxes and memories from all the places that my parents were living at, and we were moving around. So to just come back and settle down and call somewhere home, and eventually I'm home, it's something that is unexplainable. And to me, to cross to the land of orange groves and all these emotional, you know, things that connected us to the land, it was really amazing. It was an amazing moment. And just then I felt that I'm home.
For the first time.
For the first time, I felt settled in.
And how much did your family think that now peace would break out and all would be well? It was a time of high hopes.
It was for everyone. And to be honest, it turned out to be very disappointing. I think both sides, Palestinians and Israelis, have failed to lead us where we should be. We should be living side by side and in peace and understanding that we have a shared future together.
Nada is now the Palestinian director of EcoPeace Middle East, a collaboration of Jordanian, Palestinian, and Israeli environmentalists working on water security, regional integration, and sustainable solutions. The group's Israeli director and co-founder, Gidon Bromberg, was planning to join this conversation but was unable to at the last minute. Nada Majdalani began working on environmental peace-building projects in high school. She says that experience informs her work educating youth in Palestine, Jordan, and Israel.
I think anything that a teenager or a child gets exposed to during this time of growth and maturing and understanding the surroundings pretty much shapes their personality, their interests, and shapes somehow the path and the skills that they have towards approaching their careers and their interests of how they want to lead their lives in the future. When I was a teenager, my teacher at school exposed me to environmental peace building. And it was just right after, again, the signing of the Oslo Accords, when people had high hopes for peace, when we didn't even want peace only between, you know, between politicians. There needed to be a people-to-people movement to establish relationships between people as humans and as individuals that share common interests. So I was involved in environmental peace building camps and programs, and this grew up with me throughout college and university. And when I came back from my master's degree, I really wanted such a job. And it's basically a job that came true for me to join EcoPeace, because it really resembles what I really wanted to do since I was a teenager. And how this reflects on what we do with Palestinian, Israeli, and Jordanian students is very much in terms of how we can really engage with those students, not only on the understanding of the technical issues or understanding the science behind environmental issues or climate change. It's much more about how we build individuals who are agents of change, who are willing to become community activists or national activists on environmental and climate issues. We change individuals. It's a journey of individual transformation. For example, once received a message from a mom. She began the message with, "What have you done to my son?" And we were really scared. And we thought, oh my goodness, what happened to her son? She said he came back from a regional summer camp in Jordan, where he met Palestinian Israelis and Jordanians from his age. He came back much more interested to listen to the news. He became much more interested to get volunteering activities within his community and within his school. He wanted to start working out because he also felt that he wants to become more fit and more healthy. These are the individual transformations that we're looking for. And it's just a snowball effect, because once you change one individual, it becomes infectious to the whole community and to your family. And this is really rewarding. This is exactly what I like about this job, because I see specifically with working with young people, a very quick return.
That's very powerful. And I can imagine that's especially powerful. Eco-doom is something that young people talk about and struggle with, the idea that like, oh, we don't, you know, our future is really dark. I imagine what that's like in a situation where there's been generations of armed conflict, and people might have even, you know, another layer of reason to feel doubtful about their future. So do you encounter that, overcoming kind of that eco doom?
We do, but as you mentioned, there's another layer of fear of the future, because environmental issues, climate insecurity is linked much to water insecurity, which in our part of the world is also connected to the conflict. Specifically for Palestinians who are not in full control of their water resources and access to land and access to basically free movement and even freedom of speech and activism. So in that sense, yes, young Palestinians fear from the future and fear from the current situation at which they see that there's shrinking spaces, limiting, exponentially limited opportunities for growth. And this cannot basically lead to a healthy future and sustainable future for all people in the region. And this is exactly where we, not only on the level of students and youth, but also among several of our participants and stakeholders that we speak with from the three countries, Palestine, Israel, and Jordan, we try to make them understand that our destinies are very much connected. If pollution happens on one side, the other side is not immune. If water insecurity is on one side, it means that your neighbor is not happy. Your neighbor is suffering a lack of opportunities and frustration, and this frustration could blow up in your face. And this is exactly, for example, what happens in Gaza Strip, where people, 2 million people under blockade for the past 15, 16 years, lack of food and medicine supplies, lack of access to water, energy insecurity. As we speak, Gaza has 16 hours of darkness versus 4 hours of electricity. And you can imagine how this reflects on, again, the aspirations of people and how the reactions reflect on, again, the regional and the overall conventional meaning of security in the area.
And in security circles, militaries around the world talk about climate as a threat multiplier. What is EcoPeace's Middle East approach to diffusing that threat multiplier?
Well, we do recognize the literature and also the explanations and the notion that military establishments such as the NATO and also their reports by CIA, etc., that connect climate change and climate insecurity to exacerbating conflicts. What we would like to see is totally the opposite. We actually regard climate change as a potential opportunity multiplier. Once we identify that climate impact for people in conflict even is something as a mutual concern, and that they recognize that there should be a mutual understanding, that there should be cooperation and working on solutions together to reduce and mitigate the impacts of climate change, that this could be potentially an opportunity multiplier for bringing down antagonism and putting people together to look into things in a more positive direction.
Coming up, how Nada Majdalani finds inspiration in the midst of difficult times.
There are positive examples out there that have worked out for people who have historically been in war with millions of victims, millions of tragic stories, but they've found a way out, and this is what we're hoping for.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
Hey, Climate One fans, we have some exciting news. We are now on Patreon. That means that you, as a subscriber, can get access to Climate One episodes free of ads interrupting your listening experience. For just $5 a month, your Patreon membership also gets you access to our Climate One Discord channel, where you can discuss the episode with other Climate One fans and begin to build your own climate community. Best of all, your support makes future Climate One episodes possible. Join us today at patreon.com/climateone.
We're talking with Nada Majdalani, Palestinian director of EcoPeace Middle East, an Israeli, Jordanian, and Palestinian organization working for peace through environmental cooperation. One of their climate strategies, called the Green Blue Deal, advocates for sustainable development in the Jordan River Valley, in part by creating a water and renewable energy exchange between the three countries.
On the Jordan Valley Master Plan, we have done a lot of advocacy to realize some water and infrastructure projects and sanitation projects. And today we have three modern sewage treatment plants constructed and operating at a high technological level, reducing wastewater flowing into the Jordan River. We also have seen lately the declaration of intent between Jordan and Israel, which is also inspired by EcoPeace's concept and third pillar of the Green Blue Deal, which is the exchange of energy and water. The declaration of intent was signed between the Jordanian government and Israeli government and brokered by the Biden administration, specifically John Kerry. He was there during the signing of the agreement, which stipulates exchanging renewable energy produced in Jordan with desalinated water produced in Israel. So these are key successes and key achievements that we're seeing that they are progressing, but there's still so much to do. And at the moment, what EcoPeace is trying to do is to have a parallel track where renewable energy can be produced in the West Bank, wheeled through the Israeli grid towards Gaza Strip. And this also comes with lots of financial and geopolitical benefits.
And that's a really interesting idea of like trading energy for water. One area, one country has a bunch of land, can generate solar. Another country, you know, has technology, finance, and we trade energy for water, creating that interdependence. That's part of what Europe tried to do with energy and Russia. And what do you take from the Ukraine-Russia war? They also thought that trade and interdependence would create peace, and it didn't work out that way.
Indeed, and I regard it back again to the political will and to the willingness to maintain stability and to maintain world order. Unfortunately, political leadership these days is not enabling what we've been hoping for. But there is a positive example of how agreements of exchange have actually led to stability. And we could possibly go back to the positivity of these agreements and build lessons from them and see what has worked out and what did not work out. But clearly for the European Union, for example, it did work out in the 1950s based on the coal and steel agreement. After the ashes of the World War II, Germany and France basically sat down and struck a deal on coal and steel. And this led to eventually the creation of the European Union and eventually all the other European commissions that work on several aspects. And eventually now also the European Union has its own Green Deal for creating jobs and green jobs and financial instruments to adapt to climate change. And this is exactly what inspires us, is that there are positive examples out there that have worked out for people who have historically been in war with millions of victims, millions of tragic stories, but they've found a way out, and this is what we're hoping for.
Yeah, and those coal and steel deals did create an unprecedented, rather unusually long period of peace in Europe. So Ukraine doesn't disprove the possibility in other cases. You know, climate change is often thought of as abstract, doesn't quite have a human face the way armed conflict does in the Middle East. So how does climate change rank when there are more visible, direct, personal threats that people are facing every day?
It's visible some way in the extreme weather events that are happening here in the region. We have witnessed a couple of years ago a massive flash flood on the Jordanian side near the Dead Sea, which led to the loss of a school trip of 21 students. And it was a tragic event to us all. Heat waves that we're experiencing these days are terrible. And by the end of the century, the projections of scientific papers, they speak of the region increasing in temperature by 4 to 7 degrees Celsius, which means areas like the Jordan Valley could reach up to 50, 56 degrees Celsius, similar to those in the Gulf countries, which would be unhealthy at all for people to be outside. These are things that we are now witnessing in a fluctuating matter and a fluctuating manner. And it's not like something that is continuous. So therefore, people are still not relating directly these issues to climate change. But what they relate also to is the water scarcity in the region and the lack of precipitation and the shortage of water, and the drought of some wells, especially in agricultural wells and agricultural areas. But again, because climate change doesn't have a face, pretty much the public relates these water shortages to the current political conflict, and that specifically the occupation and the Israeli control over water resources, at least on the Palestinian side, is the main reason for shortage of water. On the Jordanian side, also the public does not see that this is a direct impact of climate change. They see that the flooding of Syrian refugees and refugees from Iraq in the past is basically putting more pressure on water resources and leading to the water crisis in Jordan. However, we need to recognize, and this is what we always try to educate about, is that all these issues are interconnected, and they amplify each other in terms of the impact.
Recently, the world saw a new round of violence between Palestine and Israel, with rockets being fired on both sides. And yet the work of EcoPeace Middle East continues. Working and thinking about climate and water stress full time is difficult, I know. And I talk to lots of people like that. But I can't imagine what it's like for you doing that in a conflict zone while rockets are being fired. What's that like for you?
It really makes us sometimes, for everyone else here, in at least in the office in Ramallah, and also I believe in Tel Aviv office and everywhere. When we take our cars and trains and commute to work and listen to the news and the radio and listen to stories from acquaintances, it makes us sometimes, of course, doubt if we're doing the right thing or not. We doubt if we are in the right zone. Am I this, you know, crazy, crazy region? But what makes us keep going is this big family of people who are determined and committed to our message. We are committed because if people like us give up, who else would do the job? Who else would keep the light of hope going? We're not disengaged from the reality. We do understand the different narratives. We do see that people are suffering on ground. We don't want to see more death. We don't want to see more people suffering. But sometimes these things are beyond our capability as an NGO of 50 to 60 staff. We do what we can do in terms of bringing people together to the understanding that we must survive together and that we must not be killing each other and that we have a higher agenda. It's a shared future and a shared concern. And it's basically a... I always have this metaphor of the Titanic, of being, you know, some people with adaptive capacity to climate change, to conflict, to water scarcity, to whatever. And they are just like those who are sitting in the first class, sipping champagne and in the dance and ballroom. And other people are with Jack, with less capacity to do so, and a little bit less fortunate. But when the iceberg hit the Titanic, everybody was in the Atlantic Ocean looking for survival. And everybody was forced to sit on the same boat and work things out together in order to reach safety. And this is exactly what we need to learn. Is to survive together rather than kill each other. We have a higher responsibility today to our future and to our children. I have two daughters. One is 9 years and the other is 6 years old. And I want a better future for them. No mother should be crying for the loss of her son. And no child should be burying their parents at a time that they should not be. Humanity deserves a chance, and people like us, despite all what is happening, we need to keep the hope going. I mean, even at EcoPeace, for the past 26 years, we have survived the Second Intifada, we have survived several wars on Gaza, we have survived riots and escalations in Jerusalem. But it's the spirit of the team who's working here day and night to make a difference, supported by the participants who also are supportive to us and continue to work with us. So it's not only the 50 people around the three offices of EcoPeace, it's also the courage that comes with the participants from the educational program, from some of the stakeholders, from some community leaders on ground who give us also a chance not to give up.
That's very powerful. Thank you for sharing that. Nada Majdalani is the Palestine Director for EcoPeace Middle East, an Israeli, Jordanian, and Palestinian organization working for peace through environmental cooperation. Nada, thank you so much for sharing your story and your insights from Ramallah today.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg, and to everyone else.
On this Climate One, we've been talking with two leaders working towards climate action in conflict zones. Climate One's empowering conversations connect all aspects of the climate emergency. Talking about climate can be difficult, awkward, sometimes depressing, and it's critical to address the transitions we need to make in all parts of society and all parts of the world. Please help us get people talking more about climate by giving us a rating or review if you're listening on Apple. You can do that right now on your device. You can also help by sending a link to this episode to a friend. By sharing, you can help people have their own deeper climate conversations and start to take more action. Brad Marshland is our senior producer. Our managing director is Jenny Park. Our producers and audio editors are Ariana Brocious and Austin Cologne. Megan Basilia is our production manager. Our team also includes consulting producer Sarah Catherine Coxon. Our theme music was composed by George Young. Gloria Duffy is CEO of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nonprofit and nonpartisan forum where our program originates. I'm Greg Dalton.